Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Monday afternoon, so if something should happen Monday night, you'll hear about it on Wednesday. What can I tell you? Before I introduce my first guest, someone I know fairly well, I want to remind you that we begin every single radio show, and we have for months now, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he testified before the impeachment hearings of 2019. When he got done, it took my breath away. And when he looked and sort of told his dad, it'll be okay, Dad, it'll be all right. I kind of wanted to believe him, but it turns out it's not all right. It's not been all right for him. It's not been all right for his twin brother. And frankly, it's not all right for the country and probably for the planet. So I want his words ringing in your ears when you exercise the franchise in 2020. Now the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
I'm trying to figure out how I met Reggie Harris. I know that Gail Kinney had some kind of connection to this because for those of you who don't know, Gail Kinney is a union organizer. She is a minister. And she had the lucky honor and privilege of being my campaign manager when I ran for governor in 1991 and 1992. So we have been together forever through thick and thin. And she just retired from being the president of the board of WNHNFM.org. Reggie, in an interesting way, changed my life. He's a little bit of a Renaissance man. He's a storyteller. He's a lecturer. He is a musician. He's a writer. He's kind of everything you want in your portfolio of friends. And when I've been looking at all the events of the last year and a half, actually, I realized every single time I was sort of frustrated, I said, you know, I gotta call Reggie. And of course, John Lewis just recently passed, and we had George Floyd, and we've had Black Lives Matter, and we have this racist in chief who's our president, and we've had the exposure of inequality in America that the pandemic has just made us see. I mean, in a lot of ways, you know what the pandemic is? The pandemic is 8 minutes and 46 seconds of understanding inequality in America, and that it has a Black and Hispanic face. That's really what it is. And we now all get to see it because we're all stuck at home. So I decided that I was going to reach out to Reggie. And I said to him, I want you to talk about race, racism, and racial justice. And how do we move beyond talk? And I said, I just want you to tell stories and talk to me. So let me welcome to the program my friend, my Renaissance man, a phenomenal musician, and someone with an amazing life experience. Reggie, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Arnie. It is so wonderful to see you. I think I needed a shot of your energy today.
Well, I'm so glad.
I am thrilled. You know, when you texted me the other day, I thought, oh my, yeah, this is perfect. Because it has been such an astonishing time. And I think of you so often as I make my travels. You know, the way we met was that I was recording a CD in 2018. And I put out a call to people to help me support it through, you know, social media. And Gail answered and said, I will give you money and if you will promise to come and do a concert. And so I said, great. You know, I took the money and then I hooked up and I said, where are we going to do the concert? And she said, I have this great friend with a great house and you're going to love her. And she was right about that. So that's how
we did a house concert. So I want to talk about about this moment. I want to sort of touch a little bit on John Lewis. I want to talk about whether this is really the moment of change. You know, I feel like we get so close. We get so close, and then it seems to just dissipate. But yet I feel like right now there's a synergistic effect, and we can't avoid it anymore. We're sort of being forced to embrace the change, whether we like it or not. And right. I think for many of us, it's not even liking it. It's like, oh my God, finally. So I have a book right in front of me. And the book is called Rising from the Rails. And Rising from the Rails is by a guy named Larry Tye. And it's the story of the first Black union in America. It was about the story of the Pullman porters. Yeah. And in the early 1900s, the largest employer of African-American men was the Pullman Company, all right? Yeah. So this, it's extraordinary. I mean, again, it's an extraordinary story, and it in a way, this changed my life. But let me tell you, so every July 4th, I do one of two things. I either tell a story out of Rising from the Rails, or I read Langston Hughes's poem, Let America Be America Again.
Oh, yeah.
And what is so interesting to me, Reggie, is look where I go to tell the story of America. I go to Rising from the Rails, or I go to Langston Hughes. I don't go to 1776. I don't read a document that was written by white men. I go here. But the story I want to share real quickly is this story from 1918. So when I say 1918, Reggie, what comes into your head?
The war.
The war? How about the Spanish flu? Okay, that was the big pandemic of 1918.
Yeah.
How about the Boston Red Sox, maybe? Did they win something in 19?
The last time they won before the 19, well,
Okay, so here's the story.
Okay.
It's 1918. It's the middle of the pandemic. It's the war. Everyone is incredibly poor.
Yeah.
And there is a train, it's called the Central Maine, that's on its way that goes through Freeport, Maine to Halifax. Okay. And these boys loved playing baseball, but they only could afford one baseball. That was it, okay? So it was the most treasured possession. Hmm. Well, one day they're out in the field, and the field is near the tracks.
Yeah.
And they hit a ball that just goes flying out of there, and it goes right towards the train. And there is a Pullman porter smoking his cigarette, and he sees the ball, and he takes his hand out of the pocket, and he grabs the ball, and he catches it. And everybody's just shocked. Oh my God, he caught our ball.
Yeah.
But then, what did this African-American man do? Did he throw the ball back to them, their only ball? No, he puts the ball into his pocket. Well, these little white boys from Freeport are out of their mind. They decide to write the Central Maine Railroad. It's the only ball they have. What did this guy do? Oh my God. Fast forward, it's about 3 weeks later. The same train comes through. The boys are out, and they're waiting for the train. And they see the same Pullman porter. And now they're like so upset. But the Pullman porter does something really interesting. He puts his hand into his pocket, and he pulls a ball out. Yeah. And then he throws the ball at them. But it's not the ball that they've hit. It's a ball with the signatures of all the Boston Red Sox that had just won the pennant. I've got goosebumps. It is the most, I'm gonna start to cry. It is my favorite story for the 4th of July. The only Black person they ever knew was this Pullman porter. And every couple of weeks when he would come through, he would bring them a new ball. Now remember, they only had one. And now they had, first of all, this treasure that they would never use. But then they always had balls because he would always bring them balls. And Larry tells this story, and he tells a story about telling it in Maine at a library. And all of a sudden, a guy from the back of the room said, my grandfather hit that ball.
Oh
my God. So I want people to hear this story, because it's a beautiful story. It is my 4th of July story. And as we're talking about all this emotion and negative and people dying and people being shot, I want them to also celebrate our common humanity. And I want us to understand that there are these little gifts. And you're my excuse, Reggie, for telling that story, because I think we need that story now. And you tell such wonderful stories that make me cry too. And I think if we hear these stories, we find our commonality. We get to attach ourselves.
You know, that story speaks to me in such vibrance. You know, it's a wonderful story in a local sense. Mm-hmm. But that story to me reflects the fact that African Americans have, since the time that we arrived here, we've been throwing that baseball out to America and saying, yes, we believe in this freedom. We believe in you. And we're going to take this one step further. Yes, it's a ball, but this ball can mean even more. And we throw that ball out and we say, let's engage. And unfortunately, time and again, America hasn't engaged. They haven't reached back and gotten that story. They haven't understood that the depth of the love and that we share through music and art and poetry and dance and all that we've contributed from our hands helping to build the land, that has been refused because time and time again, America has said, no, we don't really want who you are. And I mean, that's such a gorgeous, gorgeous, magical story. And, you know, stories are magical.
They are. And that's why I love you, because you're my musician, but you're also my storyteller. So I just got off the phone with my campaign manager, Gail, the one that introduced us. And she said, have him tell the story of finding the white owners that owned his family. Yeah. She said she told it as a sermon this Sunday. And she said, everybody went nuts. Everybody went nuts. And I want this to be part of my show. So I want you to share that story of finding this family, because I think it's so important. And we need these stories, especially now.
Well, we do. And, you know, I have over the years, as you know, I've come to really not just appreciate story, but, you know, I come from a people whose very existence and history centered on story. You know, stories in Africa and the story, the narrative of the tribes from which we came, from that oral culture, were the bedrock of our community and the bedrock of our individual connection to the community. And it was in 1992, you know, we didn't tell a lot of family stories growing up. We were part of the Black migration. My grandmother and grandfather came from Virginia. I knew that always. And they went to Pennsylvania to find a new life, you know, a new possibility. And they settled in Philadelphia, and that's where they raised their family, and that's where I was born. And growing up, there were little stories that came about, and every now and then we would take a trip to Virginia, and we would, you know, experience the same things, the stopping at the gas station, not being served, and the strange looks and not stopping in restaurants, you know, and all of that, and the not being able to go to the beach until Thursday because it was the special day for Black people. All of that stuff, but it was in the background because we had our own community and own set of supports. But in 1992, one of my relatives in Virginia, Kay Bush Gray, who was on my mother's side, the Hewlett family, she and others pushed for a family reunion. And it took hold, and so we all went down to Virginia to, you know, have this big reunion. And it was very strange in some ways because a lot of these people I didn't know. You know, they were distant relatives, cousins and whatever. And so we settled into the hotel and began meeting everybody. And it was this, you know, extraordinary conflagration of people. And my mother was just thrilled. My mother and my aunts, and some of the stories that they began to tell explained some of what they would in pieces share with us over the years. But on Saturday afternoon, my cousin Kay stood up in front of us. She had asked for 2 hours, and she started talking about the beginnings of our family. And as it turns out, she had been inspired by Roots, and she started to do the family genealogy and dove really deep, you know, before Ancestry.com. And she went into county records and she gathered stories. And she found that we had this connection to a plantation called Hickory Hill. Hickory Hill is in Ashland, Virginia.
Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's not the same Hickory Hill, but it was in the Williams Carter Wickham family. He and his wife owned the property now. It came down through the family actually had a signatory at the start of the country in the Declaration of Independence. So that's how deep they went. One of the family members was, I believe, Aaron Burr's lawyer. And so you've got this very deep American connection.
Lots of roots. Lots
Lots
of
of roots.
roots. Lots
Lots of
of
roots.
roots. Lots of roots.
And she explains to us that Williams Carter Wickham had six children by one of his slaves, a woman named Bibb Anna, whose family had come from the West Indies, and she was on the plantation. And he has these six children, launching these two families into history. And then she gives out these documents that she'd come up with on the Hewletts and the Wickhams and Hickory Hill and all of the really well done. I mean, I just can't say how astonishing the work that she did was. And it was, in one way, a really amazing moment for all of us. And in the same way, it was kind of overwhelming, you know, because now we have this information, which at that time most African Americans didn't really have in terms of the actual beginnings of a family. And I remember sitting in the hotel room that night and talking to my mother and looking through the book and just being fascinated. And I took it home and I read through it a couple of times. And, you know, what do you do with that information? I don't know. You know, I just thought, okay, I know this. Every now and then I would pull it out. But of course, I'm touring the country and the world and I'm talking about slavery. I'm talking about the Underground Railroad, abolition. I'm talking about civil rights. There was this barrier for me to just sort of jet this into my work because I couldn't come to a personal resolution about it. And in 2010, I got an invitation to come and teach at a music camp in North Carolina, the Squananoa Gathering. And I was going to teach a course on the spirituals and secret codes and slavery and all of that. And I'm teaching my course, and on Wednesday afternoon, as luck would have it, I prepare my class for, you know, Wednesday, and the class just takes off. They learn all the songs, they exhaust everything I'd planned, and I look at my watch and I got a half an hour. And I thought, in a half an hour, what can I do? Well, I could teach another song, but I didn't want to go on tomorrow's lesson. And I thought, wait a minute, wait a minute. I got that little piece of history that I could share with them. I could talk about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. I could talk about my family. I could connect this, and we could have a good 30-minute discussion. And it was great. It was just amazing. They seized on it, and we closed with a song. I thought, great, got through the day, we're done. One of my students comes up, a woman who's also a storyteller. And she says, that's a fabulous story. And are you in connection with them? I said, no. She says, well, you know, you're not going to believe this. But I grew up in Asheville near here. But for summers, I went to camp with a girl named Lisa Wickham, who was from Richmond, Virginia. And I know that family. And I said, really? She said, yeah, no, I haven't talked to them in years. Lisa and I, we haven't talked in 30 years, but yes, I know that family. And I'm intrigued. I'm collecting family stories, and I think I'm going to try to find her. And then she said, if I find her, are you interested in talking to her? And I said, yeah, sure, that would be great, you know. I don't even think I meant it, you know. I mean, what were the odds? So we finished the week, and she and I had a couple of other conversations, but I just forgot all about it. And I went about my business, and a year and a half went by. And I got an email from her. And you know, the amazing thing is, I just talked to her on Saturday. She just called to check in.
I'm channeling, keep going, keep going. We're on the same wavelength, keep going.
She called me on Saturday, we talked. A year and a half goes by, she sends me an email and she says, you know, I found Lisa. She's living back in Richmond. And we had a wonderful conversation, a reunion. And I told her your story and she wants to talk to you. She said she works from home. Here's the information. She said you can call any day. And I thought, oh my God, my bluff has been called. What do I do? Now I thought first, you know, well, you know how difficult these conversations can be, and I'm not really sure what
I'm
to.
sure.
So I thought about it for about 3 weeks. I couldn't pick up the phone. And I thought,
I
where's it
get
going to
it.
go? What am I? And then finally I said to myself, you know, you're being a real coward about this, you know, with what you do, who you are. You need to pick up this phone. So I dialed the phone number. She picked up the phone and said hello. And I said, hi, I'm Reggie Harris. And before I could say anything, she says, where have you been? And I said, excuse me. And she says, where have you been? I've been expecting. You were supposed to call me 3 weeks ago. And I said, well, life is complicated. And we went back and forth. And then she said, I understand we're related. And I thought, okay, here it comes. She's going to say, what proof do you have? And can you send me? And she said, how old are you? And I said, what? And she said, how old are you? I thought, that's an odd question. But I told her, and she said, I was growing up, and we're related, right? We're cousins. And I said, well, that's what my documentation says. Yeah, well, I grew up, and I didn't have a lot of cousins, and I love cousins. And by the way, if we're cousins, I'm 2 years older than you, and that means I can boss you around.
Oh, I love it.
And I said, really? And we fell into a conversation that went for about 2 hours.
Wow.
And she started talking about growing up and going to the Hickory Hill Plantation and when they did and how oppressive it felt and how this and that. And she talked about working for Obama. And we talked about this. And then she said, when are you coming down here? And I said, well, I don't know. And then as it happened, we ended our conversation. I sent her the information I had. She sent me some family information she had. She told her sister and brother about it. And that fall, I was playing, that next spring, I was playing at a school in Arlington, Massachusetts, where her sister, Wallace Raymer, was the associate superintendent of schools. And I get this email from Wallace saying, you're coming to one of my schools, and I'm coming to see you, and we're going to have lunch, which is exactly what happened. About 6 months later, I took myself to Richmond, and I met Lisa for the first time. I met her brother George, who lives around the corner on Monument Avenue, right across the street from the Lee statue. We had an amazing dinner. And at the end of the night, Lisa said, I know you're leaving tomorrow, because I was staying with her. She said, the property got sold out of the family, but it's up the road in Ashland. If you're willing, we could drive up there tomorrow. And she said, you'd have to be willing to hop over a small fence. But we could walk the land. I could show you around. And I'm thinking, okay, let me think. We drive 25 miles north of here, off on a dirt road, down a path, whatever. She said it was 2 miles back in the woods. I'm going to hop a fence on somebody else's property with a white woman I don't know that well and walk around for a couple hours. What could go wrong?
Exactly.
But I said, whatever, let's do it.
Wow.
So that's what we did. We drove to the property, and we walked on that land for about an hour and a half.
Wow.
And we embraced each other as cousins. We took pictures, and my life was changed. I will tell you that when we got to the property and we drove up and the whole 3,000 acres of what we could see of it opened up and the house sat about 100 yards back, I could not get out of the car.
Yeah.
I physically could not move. And she waited for me until I could get out, and then we had the experience. And then I, we walked and walked and walked. She showed me around the office, the gardens, and then we stood on the porch of that house. And I can't even tell you what thoughts went through my head. And eventually we had a conversation about it 3 weeks later that I said to her, I need to know what you were thinking about while we were there.
Yeah.
I took that information and turned it into a song called Hickory Hill.
Wow.
And then since then, her sister Wallace, her brother George, and I, all of us have been having this conversation of embracing each other. And we finally went to the statue of Williams Carter Wickham, which, by the way, was pulled down 3 weeks ago.
See, this is the perfect timing.
It is. And we went there 4 years ago. Actually, we went there in 2012, and we stood in front of the statue, all of us, and we said, what do we do with this? And then 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago, Clayton Wickham and Will Wickham, who are George's sons, they wrote a letter to the Richmond mayor, Duval Stoney, and to the city council and to the Richmond paper asking that the statue of Williams Carter Wickham be moved off of public land. And nothing happened except a lot of people got the shorts in a bunch.
Yeah.
And so 3.5 weeks ago, that statue was pulled down by some protesters. And Will Wickham was on the scene when it happened. And he and Clayton have been this voice in the family, pushing the family now to conversations about reparations, conversations about where we go. We're all talking about what this means, that, and then we ended up in the New York Times and on CNN. So this has been the embrace. And personally for me, it's also tagged into the shows that I do with, you know, my friend Greg Greenway, shows that I do with my friend Scott Ainsley, the shows that I do to really talk to white people about this opportunity. So for the last 3 weeks, when you texted me and said, what you've been thinking about, for the last 3 weeks, I've been watching this whole thing, knowing that we've kind of been here before, but here is not the same place that we were.
No, it's not. No. It's not, Reggie. I'm so, as frightened as I am, I'm also so incredibly hopeful. I am so incredibly hopeful. I had a friend who ran for Congress, and she didn't raise money, and she had this idea, and I remember saying, so why do you think you're going to win, Carol? And she handed me the book, The Tipping Point.
Oh,
and she said, Arnie, we're at the tipping point. And I pray, Reggie Harris, that this is a tipping point. And it's a tipping point that will not only change us, it will not only make us better, but it will prepare us better for the challenges ahead.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that, I mean, the division is, it's not useful. It doesn't help. And we have to look at not only future pandemics, but climate change. And we have to hold hands together. We have to figure this out together. And we need that effect. We need to hold on to each other. I really believe that. And in a lot of ways, maybe the timing now is so important because it enhances our ability to respond to the future even better.
I think you've really hit it. And the pandemic, I think, was the perfect foil. Well, I think the perfect foil was the man in the White House.
Yeah.
And not only him, but the entire administration and the entire power structure that is in a desperate panic about what is happening and all these voices. I think that was the start. But the pandemic was a great jumping off point. George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, those were the breaths of life that could not be ignored.
And on that note, I have to let you go. I don't want to let you go. So here's the deal. We can't wait so long to talk again.
Yeah.
There's so much we have to do. There's all of these gaps that we have to fill in. And I can't believe it. I've been sensing Reggie Harris. And I've been like, okay now. The timing couldn't be better. Hey. And remember that 1918 story?
It is
so special. And to me, it is the best. It
One
is
of my
the
great
best.
Uncles was a Pullman porter.
Well, there you go. Reggie Harris, join us again. If you go to my Facebook page, you will see all about him. He is a remarkable man. Invite him to play music. Listen to him. Have him tell stories and have him take you into the South because you take us on pilgrimages and tours. And it's through your eyes that we get to understand what happened. So thank you very much. I'm glad we didn't do the politics. I'm glad we did the stories.
Thank you. I love you.
I love you too. Ciao.
Bye.
All right, everyone. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We're going to a break.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. As electric vehicles become more mainstream, the demand for lithium-ion car batteries is growing. But to increase production, the industry needs more lithium, cobalt, and nickel. One possible source is batteries that are no longer in use.
It's a bit of a waste to just have batteries sitting in a landfill. And there's opportunity there to reuse those materials, make them good as new.
That's Canal Falfer of Li-Cycle. The company uses a two-step process to recover more than 80% of the materials in old lithium-ion batteries.
We take the batteries and shred them. And then phase two of the process is then to take that mixed material and separate each of the elements through chemical processing.
The approach generates less carbon pollution than mining those minerals from the ground. And it solves another problem the booming industry is grappling with, how to safely and sustainably dispose of spent batteries. Li-Cycle has a demonstration plant in Canada, and Falfer says it's building a new facility in Rochester, New York. Last December, the company shipped its first commercial load of recycled battery material to a customer, a critical milestone on the road to addressing this global challenge. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Oh, tell it on the mountain.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and our producer Ken Barnes. I want to remind everyone that we Zoom on Monday afternoon, so if something should happen Monday night, well, you'll hear about it on Wednesday. But maybe I'm prescient. So Bob Hennelly has joined us on numerous occasions. He writes for The Chief Leader. He writes for NJinsider.com. He writes for Salon.com. He's just a wealth of knowledge, and he also lives in Jersey. So he had sent me a piece that he had just written at Salon.com, which, by the way, is phenomenal. And I have mined it for information. I pulled more nuggets of facts out of it and just kept plopping them in front of people going, this is why it's going to get worse and worse and worse. And it's not just the pandemic. It's all these issues on top of the pandemic that are just going to, I think, crater us emotionally and economically. And the piece at Salon.com was entitled by Bob Hennelly, an eviction and foreclosure crisis is looming. Expect the economic situation to decay tremendously between now and the fall of 2020. Now that was the excuse for Robert Hennelly to join me on the air. And then this morning I say, wait a minute, what's this about a shooting in New Jersey that the son of a federal judge is now dead? The husband has been hurt. And I am looking at all this as I'm looking at what's going on in Portland, where, you know, they've got these secret police that are rounding people up in Portland. And, you know, supposedly they're sort of coming out of AG Barr. And now I'm looking at what's happening with an assassination attempt, let's be honest here, on a judge. He didn't get his target, but he got part of the family. And I'm like, what is happening? The wheels are more than falling off economically. Now I feel like there's a level of instability that is so incredibly frightening. So let me welcome Bob Hennelly to the program. And I'm going to tell you that as the news and information is breaking, Bob has been collecting it. Bob has sort of been putting the sort of the pieces together for us. And we will get to your eviction piece because that's very important. But tell us what we know now about what happened to this judge in New Jersey. I just want to let everyone know this was a judge that was appointed by Barack Obama. Not by this president. This is someone who's been working on a number of high-profile cases that touch on Epstein, on Deutsche Bank. But more importantly, you have details that I think are important.
Right.
So, but I want to get beyond the details. I want to sort of see how you connect the dots.
Well, I guess what we first woke up to today was a really disturbing news that in North Brunswick, it's kind of a suburban area of New Jersey, mid-central Jersey, Judge Esther Salas, who was appointed, as you said, by President Obama. She was the first Latina in New Jersey to be appointed to the federal bench. It was a big deal. Well-respected jurist. Apparently, an individual disguised as a FedEx driver delivery person came to the home on the tree-lined street, and when her husband opened the door, he shot the suspect, who's now been identified as Roy Den Hollander, who is, in Pulitzer's reports, a lawyer who was known as being a virulent anti-far-right, anti-feminist character featured on Fox News, who had a couple of matters in front of the judge. And the tragedy here, of course, was that the 20-year-old son of Judge Salas came to give aid to his father, and he was killed in the process.
So let me just say something. You just said something. So has this attorney that committed suicide, the one that killed the son?
Apparent suicide.
Apparent suicide. This attorney has been featured on Fox?
We used on Fox. That's what, there was stuff from Neil Cavuto, prior shows that are all over online. I was just mining this when called in. I didn't want to keep you waiting.
Yeah. Okay. So he's not just a lawyer someplace. He's a lawyer that at least has had some sort of media profile.
Right, exactly. And one that's been known
for an issue with this judge.
Right, exactly. So, and this is also has to be put in the context of this period of time of the reign of terror of President Trump, who even before he became president was attacking federal judge Gonzo Curiel in that case involving Trump University, where he called him out and suggested that his rulings against Trump's position was somehow linked to the fact that he was, quote unquote, a Mexican, which he was not, because of the fact the president wanted to build a border wall. Subsequently, Trump has gone on ad hominem attack on Twitter against the judges that have been deliberating on the prosecutions involving his cronies, specifically Flynn, Stone, and Manafort, all of whom were convicted. So this is kind of the atmospherics of, and we've seen a dramatic increase in threats on federal judges. Now, what's so wholly crazy about this is that we have this acting out in Portland, Oregon, where the federal government and the bar Trump Access uses the pretext of wanting to stop graffiti on the federal courthouses, where they put these federal officers without any kind of identification onto the streets of Portland without official approval from the local or state authorities, and begin taking people in an extra legal proceeding off the streets to question them in federal custody. I mean, so he's defending the artifice while he undermines the actual living, breathing aspect of the judiciary, which sets a climate where people feel they can go to a judge's house and just assassinate a family member.
I'm glad that you made the connection to what was happening in Portland, because we're still so shocked by what we see. And as you pointed out, the excuse is that unasked by the mayor, unasked by the governor, they're sending these people in unmarked, okay? I mean, what did someone say the other day over the weekend? I think it was Glenn Smith said, they're wearing camouflage in downtown Portland. Now, excuse me, but why are you wearing camouflage in downtown Portland? Maybe if you wore something that looked like bricks or cement blocks, you might be able to camouflage yourself, but you're wearing camouflage. And the only reason why they're dressed in camouflage is to intimidate. The only reason why is to frighten. So not only do you not know who they are, not only do they not identify, not only are they not wearing insignias that you know what they're doing, but Donald Trump's excuse, I think he wrote something in June, that they're to protect these federal buildings from what? From graffiti. Right. And then you find out that they're picking people up so far from a federal building that, you know, you would need binoculars to be able to see whether it's a federal building within any kind of eyesight. And then you see what happens to this federal judge who happens to be the first Hispanic judge in New Jersey. Right. I mean, it's shocking.
It is. It comes to mind that amazing film by Costa Gravis called Missing, that captures the 1982 atmospherics of Chile. And this is about Charlie Harmon, the American journalist who went missing, and the role of his father is played by Jack Lemmon, and they go down there to try to reconstruct what happened. And it's so hard to do because all the social institutions of Pinochet's Chile, of course, you have to remind people that that government rose to power with the help of the United States, violently overthrowing the Allende government that was democratically elected. This is very much the same atmospherics. And people can't dismiss it. And it even goes to the extent of, we had a situation on, we talked about it on the show, May 29th, Patrick Underwood, a beloved DHS uniformed federal protection officer protecting the Ron Dellums courthouse in Oakland. The night, there were a couple of nights of great civil unrest in Oakland, and this active duty Air Force sergeant, part of the Boogaloo crew, that is far right wing people, killed this man. And apparently, what ended up happening was they found out they had him in custody because after he executed and assassinated Patrick Underwood, he went on to kill a deputy from California, sheriff deputy, and seriously wound his partner after he used improvised explosive devices in an ambush attack. So far, the only flesh and blood things I've been able to see have been perpetrated by the far right wing, facilitated and encouraged by the President of the United States. Did I miss a point?
No, you haven't missed a point, Robert. And this story should be told over and over again. Yes, Ken.
You did miss one point. I just want to tie it to one other thing, and that is the way in which the Trump administration is adding the skinheads and the white nationalist terrorist groups to work with the federal officers in perpetrating this terrorist attack on civilians. You know, ICE is starting what it calls a pilot program in Chicago on September 17th.
Right.
And they are sending targeted invitations to the people, the kind of people that they think might want to join with ICE. And they call them citizens academies, to teach them. And, you know, among the things that they're teaching these citizens who are not actual federal officers, they're teaching them firearms use and the ins and outs of how to arrest people. So they're basically recruiting the folks that went through the streets in Charlottesville and, you know, were bashing heads there, the private terrorists, with the military. And to me, that's even scarier than just the military in Portland, although it's hard to say which is scarier.
So, Robert, I think what we're hearing from Ken and what we're seeing with what you're talking about and we're seeing what's going on in Portland is that now when you have the police, the military, these paramilitary that are not military, these civilians that dress up like they're in the military, these civilians that wear camouflage, you don't even know who's in front of you anymore. You don't know. And think about it. The whole point about government and finding security is the sense of trust. What they have just done is they have actually undermined every cop in America. Right. If you want people to create a relationship with the police by doing what Donald Trump is doing, is that he is now making everyone feel even more vulnerable because you don't even know who the cops are anymore, Robert.
Right. And that's the thing that's going on here is you have a situation where he is also, I mean, it's so important to look at the TikTok narrative. It was just a couple of days after Pat Underwood was killed that you have that whole June 1st craziness with the president using the park police and elements of the National Guard to stage this kind of Kristallnacht thing where they're going to restore order by attacking peaceful protesters so he can walk across the street and hold a Bible to take on the trappings of being the enforcer of law and order as he shreds the Constitution in the process. And that's why I say this Pinochet metaphor, I think, works so appropriately.
So we're going to learn more during the course of the next couple of days, and you are on it, and we're calling you literally as the information is just being shared. So I want to let everyone to understand that while it's not quote-unquote premature, it is obviously going to be fleshed out even more, and we're going to get more detail. So I really want, Bob, to go to the story that you wrote at Salon.com, because I've been mining it like crazy. And the whole idea about evictions and foreclosures and what's going to start happening and just the incredible numbers. What was it that 1/5 of all the renters in America could find themselves in an eviction situation by the end of September? And what you pointed out, which was so accurate, is that can you imagine in the middle of a pandemic where people have lost their health insurance, they're going to lose their unemployment benefits, now they're going to lose their homes, and there's an order that comes down because we're in the second wave of COVID, even though we've never come out of the first wave, and they're telling you to shelter in place. Where the frick do you go?
Well, and the thing about this is that the response to the pandemic has been patchwork, and that's been its problem, right? Yes. You've had some isolated cases of enlightenment where there's been regional compacts here in the Northeast. We've had some kind of enlightenment, but generally it's failed because it's been a patchwork. Similarly, the financial response to the fallout has been patchwork. So you will have enlightened leadership, Governor Inslee in Washington extending the moratorium, Nevada not so much. And so although we are facing a national public health emergency and a consequential financial crisis, neither one of them are being comprehensively managed, which creates this anxiety and situation where people really don't know their situation, and that adds to the anxiety. It's also important to understand that even before this all came apart, as we said before on this show, 40% of Americans, according to the Federal Reserve, couldn't scrape together $400 without borrowing it. Right. Now that's probably well over 50%. And the other thing is to look at the historical parallel here in the sense that we talk about the Great Depression and the drop and the rise in unemployment being a parallel to that, and in some cases greater than. It's important to understand the period of the Great Depression played out over a few years. This went down in two quarters. So you're talking about the scale and velocity of this that's unprecedented, with the soft landing being a pandemic.
It's just so shocking. And as you pointed out, it's not just patchwork. Patchwork is something we've seen in the past. What this is you've got a president that's questioning the doctors. You've got a president that's questioning the scientists. You've got a president that doesn't want to fund the testing. You've got a president that, I mean, so you've not only got patchwork, you now are fighting your president to even know what the facts are, to even be able to support the people that are supposed to be caring for you. I mean, it's cataclysmic because it is just beyond awful. And in a lot of ways, I now describe him as the murderer in chief, because right. this is not a neutral position. This is not just questioning scientists, like you're questioning climate change, even though if you question climate change, you'll probably die, but maybe your kids will die and you will survive. This is now happening, as you said, in real time at the moment, and you can literally count the bodies and see what's happening to your hospitals. You don't have to be told it may happen. You are watching it happen.
Right, right. It's kind of like a rolling Auschwitz.
Yes. Oh, my God.
And so I think it's important also to understand that the public is not as fully aware of the nature of this virus. There's a few things we need to review and need to be repeated. One of them is that the concept of herd immunity has been widely discredited now, and yet it's still driving the right-wing Malthusian political imperative to open up all schools and open up everything, tear the scab off, march on. You're going to lose a few people, but on their skulls, you'll build a glorious prosperity for your grandchildren. Well, we know that Boris Johnson didn't like that, didn't work out for him. But in reality, what's turning out is that people can get, one, reinfected with this miserable disease, yeah. That even if you manage to have a brush with it, you could be permanently disabled in ways you're still figuring out. And here's the fun part. You may remember the mighty Diamond Princess. Remember that cruise ship from hell? Remember that one, right?
So, the one that anyone to deboard because he didn't want the numbers right. to go up.
Well, this is the bad news for the asymptomatic crowd. These are people who don't show any symptoms. They did CAT scans on the asymptomatic 76 individuals who didn't have symptoms, and over 50% of them had lung abnormalities, boys and girls. That's right.
God.
You can be part of the walking wounded and not know it. So we really don't have a clue about this disease. And meanwhile, we're watching on MSNBC the daily numbers about the death count to judge what we're going to do, like Willie the Weatherman with Romper Room. What temperature is it going to be today? Oh, I'll wear my it's going to be raining out. And the reality is, as CDC says, that may be only 10% of actually what's going on.
And explain how they get to that number, because I read that piece and it was like so damn sobering. So we've always known there's probably an undercount. And you've right. taught me that, because you talked about the undercount, because you were describing what happened in New York City.
Right.
That they were getting more dead people out of apartments,
right.
which meant
excess
they
deaths.
never right. got to the hospital.
Right. And right. so you have to, in order to understand the general circumstance, you have to be very granular. So back when we first started having this conversation, it was in the New York City, New Jersey area. What I was hearing from people that were doing the work of collecting bodies, wherever they were, right. was that they were seeing this exponential increase in heart attacks in people's homes. So in the five boroughs of New York City, around that time of year, you'd normally have 20 to 30 folks pass at home from a coronary, from a heart attack. They were seeing 300 a day. And those numbers weren't being incorporated right. in the fireside chat substitute Governor Cuomo for FDR, where he was talking about managing the curve. In fact, he would report discharges from the hospital as happy numbers, when in reality, they could be people that were discharged that went home to die in their parlor.
Oh, so again, we don't have an accurate count on how many people have COVID because right. we're not doing the adequate testing. Of course, Donald Trump doesn't want to test because if you don't test, you don't have it. And I'm right. hoping, I'm wondering how many pregnant women he knows. But anyway, so as I'm thinking about all this, you talk about what's happening with the evictions. You talked about what's happening with health insurance. I mentioned it to people. You know, I've been a single payer Medicare for all person. I ran on that in 1984 right. when I ran first. I actually incorporated it when I ran for governor. I mean, I was so ahead of myself, it was crazy.
It's
but now I'm looking at the moment, and you mentioned how many people have lost their health insurance because of what's happened with this unemployment number.
Right, right.
But that number, again, is inaccurate. So, Bob, share the real number, because the number isn't just about the number of people who were employed who lost their health insurance. Give the bigger number, because I want people to hear it.
Kaiser is good on this. So you have your 5.8 million, 6 million individuals who lose their employer-based health care, and then you also have maybe as many as 20 some odd million to 23 million people who lose it as a consequence of that. And sadly, many of this can include the first responders and essential workers who have died from COVID, and we've talked about this before, whose families now have been contaminated because of their hero service and then lose their health care.
So I always tell the story that I would introduce, the reason I married Marty, I mean, I loved Marty, but I said to Marty, you have to marry me because I don't need to get married again. I said, yes, you do. And he goes, why? I said, because I need your damn health insurance. Okay? I mean, that's
how romantic.
How romantic. I would introduce him as my health plan. I mean, I literally would do this. And here's the kicker, Bob, and I just want people to hear this. So he thought that I was going to be like on CNN and make $1 million. Well, that never happened. So he decided that when he died, his pension would end with him. Oh, screw you. How would you have done this to me? But here's the thing that he made a mistake about. He forgot to cancel his health insurance. So the gift that keeps on giving is I am still on my deceased husband's health insurance. I just want people to understand it is the greatest gift he ever gave me. But as we're talking about the number of people who have lost their jobs and lost their health care, think of their family members who needed that health care in order to go to a doctor. You are now telling us the stories of these frontline workers who die in the service of, you know, dealing with this pandemic. Right. But when they die, their families lose their health insurance.
Sucks. But there is also, I would say, I do want to capture one optimistic thing is that there are signs, and the nation did good reporting on this, about people resisting these evictions and people pulling together as they did in the 30s and subsequently periodically to stand with each other, to stand with their neighbors and family, as was done during the Depression in places where in the Midwest, where armed farmers actually showed up at these sheriff evictions and dissuaded the sheriff from going ahead with the foreclosure. We need a lot more of that in America for this fall.
Well, I mean,
the 70s or 80s, what is that? That they were still doing that.
Well, it really was a huge trend in the progressive era back then before the Depression. It has had times, and there's even been an anti-foreclosure movement in
Brooklyn.
America's cities during the whole Great Recession, where so many African American families lost their homes to the likes of Wells Fargo. But this stuff won't wait to the general election. That's what I'm trying to say is that we need direct action now. We can't wait for Uncle Joe to get elected.
No, you're absolutely right. And again, I want to remind everyone what you said, that perhaps 1 in 5 renters could face eviction in September. Understand what we know about the fall. They're talking about the fact that we'll see a rise in the pandemic, that we're going to see a second wave. Where are these people going to go? You are looking at evictions as potential super spreader events. Right. That's what an eviction is. It isn't just goodbye, give me the keys. It is goodbye. And where do they go? They go to a place. I mean, if they go to a shelter, they can infect the shelter. If they go to a neighbor's house to, you know, sleep on the couch, they can infect the neighbor. These evictions, Bob, are about you and me. Let's be selfish. It isn't just about the person that's losing access to their rental space. It means that I am now more vulnerable because of their vulnerability. This is what the pandemic is about. And you're absolutely right. It cannot wait till November.
That's right.
Do the Republicans get it? I'm just trying to, are they suicidal? Do they not love their families? Do they not love any of their constituents? Because they die too. I mean, Republicans die, Christians die, Jews die. And it's even not just about dying, as you pointed out. What are we learning? That these people that, you know, manage not to get horrific, you know, situations from getting COVID-19 could still have permanent damage. Right. Permanent damage is not only a healthcare bill in perpetuity, but permanent damage means those people may not be able to do their jobs or take care of their families, and that ability has been shrunk because of this illness. It has enormous waves of economic repercussions.
And no, I totally agree.
Oh my God.
And human repercussions.
It's economic. It's human. It's
generational. I mean, it's generational consequence. And we should talk about it some other time, but there's a direct, I would say, this is like the summer of 1932. This is very much like that period of time.
But I want to remind everyone that it's like the summer of 1932, but at the same time, because of COVID, it's 1932 on steroids. Robert Hennelly, I love you. I'm so glad I found you. Thank you for the information about the federal judge. I'm so heartbroken.
We'll stay on it.
All right, take care. Bye. Anyway, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's a Tuesday edition. We'll schmooze tomorrow.
We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved like a tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved like a tree that's planted by the water.